romance both as a genre and as a subgenre that appears in, you know, all sorts of books and media, it's human connection. And I think we are always very intrigued and invested in human connection because that is why we want to keep consuming a piece of media. I always think that if a book has good characters but nonsensical plot, I'll probably still keep reading because I'll make sense of the plot eventually, you know? Like, I want to see what these characters get up to. Versus if a book has some really strong plot but nonsensical characters, I'm not going to care enough to keep reading. And so romance is another element of that. It is something that really, really drives your investment in these, you know, fictional entities, and it keeps you really intrigued by what they're about to get up to next.
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 88 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me as always is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, MJ Kuhn. How are you, MJ?
Hello, I'm lovely. I was actually thinking, I look very Chewie today. I got like this big old brown sweatshirt on.
Nice.
I just need to learn my Wookiee call and then I'll be ready for you.
I can take the Jim Butcher clip and just toss it in here.
There we go. Yeah, wait. Yeah. I'll go like this. And then we can pretend I did it.
All right, there we go. Yeah, everyone's going to hear MJ doing it perfectly.
Yeah, you'll fix it in post.
Oh, man. And if you want to support MJ, my dear Chewie, with her books, you can pick up Among Thieves, her debut novel, and its sequel, Thick as Thieves. If you want some fun heists and all kinds of crazy stuff like hatchets and assassinations and people sailing on ships because that's the craziest thing in the world.
Even though it's not.
Whoa, holy crap. No, there's a lot of fun stuff that happens in Thick as Thieves and Among Thieves, and I think you'll really enjoy it. If you want to support MJ and her work as well, you can check out the cover for my debut novel, Mushroom Blues, which is now officially live. Go check it out on Instagram, on my Twitter. You can go to FemFi Addict and go check out the official cover reveal. The cover reveal trailer that I animated is on YouTube if you want to go check that out and hear some original music from my two friends in Sweden. Just bask in all the mushroom glory. And it's coming out March 19th. So you can, get yourself a copy and beat the winter blues and enter the Fungalverse and all that fun stuff.
Hell yeah.
As well, a quick note for everyone out there listening or watching, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live. So check the links in the description to support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast app. And subscribe to the FemFi Addicts YouTube channel where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And now, joining us once again is the amazing Chloe Gong, bestselling author of These Violent Delights, Immortal Longings, and more. How are you today, Chloe?
I am very good. Thank you for having me yet again. I love recording for the future. It is so trippy. Right?
It is really trippy. It's like our daily existence. And
like you're talking about things that have happened in the past, but they're in the future. Like, I'm pretty sure there's a specific term for that sort of tense because the Bible uses it. It's like the things that are so certain to happen that they have already happened.
Did you just compare us to the Bible? I love that.
Yes.
That's what we're all about.
We are the Bible of SFF Poddick.
Now we're the Bible.
Correct.
Damn, Chloe. You're just a charmer.
You're just dropping them here. I love it.
Two episodes in a row. My God. Before we dig deeper into the episode, a quick word from our sponsor. Novello is an exciting new publishing and reading platform whose goal is to be the go-to for all things writing and storytelling. Their platform offers an intuitive, user-friendly way for writers to create and share their awesome stories for readers to enjoy, all while maintaining total control over their stories. Everything from the content to cover art and pricing is all controlled by the story's author. Novello also offers social features such as message boards, direct messaging, and a news feed, where you can post updates to your followers. With future plans including support for comics and a marketplace for users to sell other writing-related services, the future of this platform is looking bright. And the best part? It's all available for free. No sign-up fees, no membership, just a growing library of epic tales. Sign up now to bask in the magic of books, where you can enjoy tales like Blackwater, an epic adventure by an award-winning author, or Limbo, The Door Above the Lake, a terrifying battle for survival. Whether you're a casual reader or a professional writer, Novello is the place for you. Visit them at novello.com, that's N-O-V-E-L-O.com. And now, enjoy the rest of this episode of SFF Addicts. A heads up, this is part two of our two-part chat with Chloe, so I recommend checking out part one to get to know her better. Today, though, we're getting steamy here on the podcast as we delve into a mini masterclass on writing romance. So to kick this off, we're going to go a bit broad at first. From your perspective, what is the appeal of romance as a concept?
Oh, that is a very chewy, broad question. I think romance, both as a genre and as a subgenre that appears in, you know, all sorts of books and media, it's human connection. And I think we are always very intrigued and invested in human connection because that is why we want to keep consuming a piece of media. I always think that if a book has good characters but nonsensical plot, I'll probably still keep reading because I'll make sense of the plot eventually, you know? Like, I want to see what these characters get up to. Versus if a book has some really strong plot but nonsensical characters, I'm not going to care enough to keep reading. And so romance is another element of that. It is something that really, really drives your investment in these, you know, fictional entities, and it keeps you really intrigued by what they're about to get up to next.
It's like, are their pants going to come off? What's going to happen?
Exactly. It could be anything.
It could be anything.
Maybe one sock.
Oh my God. Well, their pants stayed on? How could they?
That's the surprise.
Subversion.
So, moving into talking about fiction, romance and fiction specifically, what drew you towards including romance in your stories as, you know, that kind of subplot? And as kind of a sub question, do you have any stories that you remember reading that had a great romantic plot or subplot that really kind of cemented that you wanted to explore that in your work?
Mm-hmm. Well, what drew me to wanting to include it was because there were so many, you know, pieces of either media or my favorite book series that a big part of my investment was caring for the characters and their blossoming romance. And as a result of it, you know, as mentioned in part one, which people should definitely listen to, a lot of my reason for reading was the escapism. And I think being able to cheer for a character's romance is like prime supreme escapism. Like, it is just, it's in this enclosed world where if you are reading like romance of the capital R, nothing bad's going to happen to them. Like, they are going to get their happily ever after in ways that you can't guarantee in real life, right? That is the comfort of romance with a capital R, which I don't always write. Like, sometimes I write lowercase romance where things can get a bit iffy, but romance in general kind of promises a certain level of, like, you can invest your time and energy into these characters and you can follow them around and get a lot of joy and serotonin from them, and things will play out fine. So a lot of my time was spent like free blogging GIFs of characters whose hands would graze once in the TV. You know? And I was just really, really invested in that. And when I started writing my own stories, I was thinking, what was it that really got me committed to the next book as it was coming out, to the next episode? And it was these moments sometimes. And so anytime I'm approaching a story, I tend to write romance as a subplot. It's not really the, you know, how do I get them from plot like point A to point B? But I am always going to be thinking of it as the kind of undercurrent thread of why do we care about these characters while they get from plot point A to plot point B.
Yeah, I love, just like the gentle grazing. It's just like, yeah. Oh my god, their shoulders brushed.
Oh like, my god,
but in the right context, it's electric.
Exactly. Ooh, in real life, it's electric, MJ. Come on.
Also, only in the right context, though.
Only in the right context. He just grazed my hand.
You're like, okay, weirdo.
So I wanted to touch on something that you brought up last episode, which is like we were talking about sort of like industry trends and YA and things like that. But one of the big subgenres in the industry right now is romanticy. Like that is the hot thing. Mm-hmm. Like everyone, every publisher is looking for the next, you know, like Sarah J. Maas or Chloe Gong or who's the new one? The Fourth Wing. I can't remember the author's name.
Rebecca
Yarros. Yeah. So it's kind of like they're clamoring. They're clamoring for this, and readers are clamoring for it. Why do you think romance storylines fit well in fantasy, and why do you think it's clicking so much right now, in particular for modern fantasy readers?
I have my theories. I think the romance genre has always been very well selling. I think it has always had its appeal for the people who are very, you know, interested in these stories, right? Romance has been bestsellers. Like, it has been a best-selling machine for a very, very long time. And I think what happens is anytime a genre and its, like, areas of interest go outside the target audience, it will often, like, need some sort of mechanism to be able to infect people, not to start thinking about it like as a virus, but I kind of feel like that's what happens, right? When you look at a lot of these big romanticies, they are oftentimes accessible to readers who don't normally pick up those types of books. There's so often, if something has suddenly blown up, you will see some rando on the subway reading that book and they don't call themselves a reader because that book has reached them and it has reached outside their normal target audience. And I think when you wrap up a romance, which traditionally very best-selling, but has been, you know, a victim to misogynistic society where women do not feel like they can be like openly reading it, and you package it into a fantasy, which is currently very cool, very trendy, like Game of Thrones did very well. It's a cool thing now. It becomes like a vehicle that people very easily pick up and read and explodes outward. So I think we're kind of in an age where romanticy is a very perfect marriage between two genres and it's working.
Yeah. And it's kind of like it's capturing the zeitgeist in a way where the interest has superseded the judgment. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, yeah, it's like if you're on a bus or whatever and you see someone reading, I don't know. I think like Outlander was kind of like the precursor to a lot of this. Mm-hmm. But maybe Outlander was aimed at like an older audience than a lot of the romanticy is now. Mm-hmm. Whereas like, you know, my mom's like huge into Nora Roberts and Danielle Steele and stuff like that. But then there's like the romance that people consume where it's like, you know, self-published romance authors, they're just like banging out, sorry, not a good use of words. pumping out's not a good use of words.
Perfect use of words.
Right? However inappropriate. This is birthing so many stories.
I mean, there you go.
they're literally like 5, 6, 7, 8 books a year.
Yeah, well, and the audiences are voracious.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it's like, that audience has always been such a powerful driving force. And I think as soon as you put like a lot of romanticy has the fantasy face. And when you explain it to, you know, a local, right? Like people who are not normally readers, you don't really explain the romance part. You explain the fantasy part. And because romance is very like gripping and addicting as soon as you're in it, that's what captures you, even if you weren't originally pitched into it that way.
It's like how you pitch your books. You're like Romeo and Juliet, Shanghai.
And then you learn about the Civil War. I do it the opposite way.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a different switcheroo. It works both ways is what we're hearing.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of things that work, when you're writing your romantic subplots, I'm curious because Adrian knows, regular listeners know, writing anything vaguely romantic is like my kryptonite. Like I'm, I've done it a little bit. I'm very uncomfortable doing it.
Had some saucy stares and all.
I did. I had the gentle hand grazes.
But like dirty fantasy, like gritty world hand grazes. Right. Where it's just like they're not that clean.
But I've been excited for this masterclass because like I need to learn. Like I need this masterclass. What do you think makes for good like on-page chemistry between characters? Ooh. And on the flip side, what are like chemistry killers or like things that signal like friend zone or just really flat energy between two characters?
Oh, that is a great question. And I think the way I approach it kind of differs on my ultimate goal. I was thinking about this the other day because I posted a very gentle PSA on Instagram where I was like, now that we've actually just been talking about this with the previous question, I was like, guys, thank you for your enthusiasm, but Immortal Longings is very much not a romantasy because if you go in expecting romance, you're gonna get two people who kind of are really mean to each other all the time. Like, are they attracted to each other? Yes. But this is an Antony and Cleopatra retelling. Like, they might kill each other.
These are not people we want to aspire to be.
Exactly. Exactly. So I feel like with romantic chemistry, like, there is different, like, there are different ways to go about it depending on the aims. And I think when I'm writing it in young adult, the ultimate aim is you really want to ship these two characters. You want them together. You want them married. You want them to have three kids and live happily in the countryside forever, right? So at every moment they're interacting, you want that reader to be affirming these two people make each other better. In some way, whatever they are missing in their lives, that other character brings to them in a positive and good way, which isn't to say they like complete them in any way. Like, I think that's problematic to give teenagers because, you know, an individual is already a complete person. But bringing in a love interest of some sort is always an improvement on their life, whether it's an improvement on their like outlook on the future or their actual external circumstances. It could differ, right? Because, you know, sometimes in fantasies, that love interest might actually make things worse. Like, maybe they're rival families and they kill a lot of people. Like, they could make things worse on the surface. But if you really look at like their internal insides, that heart has to mash together well. And if you like ask the ultimate question, are these people good together if you remove all their external circumstances? And the answer is yes. Hopefully that means like every time they interact, there is that chemistry that builds and builds and builds until they get together. Versus I think sometimes when you are writing like romance where you are looking at just chemistry, it can also be like, how do they make each other worse, right? How do we make this interesting? And I really had to think about this like writing my adult fantasy because are they good for each other? No. But are you entertained? I hope so. Like,
yes.
I always like the metaphor I go to is that we all know that one couple that are so toxic and yet you're never gonna tell them to break up. Like every time one of them calls and they're like, you won't believe what they did, you're like, oh my god, tell me more. Because it's just so entertaining. Like morally, is it kind of bad? Yeah. But it's entertaining, right? So I do think that can also be a chemistry element, right? Ultimately, it just depends on what you want that reader to feel and what the outcome is. It doesn't always have to be the end game, but it has to in some way be encouraging, like that next page turn. I think chemistry killers are the ones that are like, you have told the reader that they are good for each other, but there is no indication of that for what you understand the characters to be. Like, I think that's why so many books of like the 2010s got criticism for like insta-love, because people understood that we liked seeing romance. They didn't quite understand what it was about the romance that you liked. You can't just inject it in and be like, okay, they're together now, because it's just, it's not believable. Like, we have to be given the mechanisms to root for it, which is oftentimes in the small things. It's those like, every few pages you're confirming, yes, I would like to see this continue. And if, so long as that answer, like so long as that question keeps getting answered in the little gestures, then it's, you know, the chemistry keeps building.
Mm-hmm. And I like what you brought up about sort of like this balance between like, are they making each other better or is this shit really toxic?
Yeah.
You know? And it doesn't make you a terrible person if you want to be on the phone, like talking to Marley about her toxic relationship or whatever. It's just like, this is like my Netflix, you know, just pick up the phone and see what's up.
It absolutely is.
But I wanted to kind of dig deeper into that a little bit in terms of like writing healthy romance and how you can still keep it interesting for readers, because it's like healthy romances don't necessarily equate to good story conflict. And then on the flip side, it's like, what tips would you have for keeping a romance storyline interesting without making the, like, if you're going to make it a toxic relationship, without making that toxicity like the quintessential thing about it, you know?
Yeah,
what I mean?
Like something like worth modeling.
Like if the toxicity is just everything, then that's kind of like the other end of the spectrum of this is too healthy and it's kind of boring. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a great question. I think it's that there has to be an understanding of what exactly the characters and the relationship is trying to achieve. And I really don't think healthy relationships are boring, because it should be the external circumstances that are actually pushing them constantly into like exciting situations. Like, I think some of my favorite books are the ones where the characters have actually gotten together already and they themselves are like in domestic bliss, but things just keep going wrong around them. Like, that's the most entertaining thing to me ever, because it is not manufactured tension for the sake of it. It is actually things they have to conquer together to even push that relationship stronger. So I feel like I always think about it as, how do you maneuver the external circumstances, not the internal conflict? And I honestly think that's a bit of a personal preference. I think there are many, many long form series where the couple just keeps finding new things to fight about. Personally, that's not my favorite, but I understand like why that is a certain tactic. Like, as you mentioned, it keeps things interesting because there keeps being a new hurdle to cross. But I really like the tactic where it's like, you understand what it is that makes them make each other better. You understand what it is that they are filling in for each other. And then you keep making the situation around them get worse so that they can keep stepping up and proving like themselves. With these Violent Delights, I think I went into it very clear that they are like enemies, but they are never at different power balances. I think it's really, really easy for us to write, you know, this group is in some way controlling the other group, and that's why they're star-crossed, because like oftentimes it's like the male character, like in heterosexual relationships, where the male character is like controlling around the female character. And that is also a tactic, but personally, I think it's interesting when they are completely on even ground, and the things that keep them apart are their families, their circumstances, the politics, the country, the nation, the stakes, right? And I feel like you get to keep emphasizing that it is healthy without necessarily the situation being good in any way. Like, in the first duology, people just kept dying and getting blown up and getting killed. But are they still good to each other? Kind of. Like, they're still kind of protecting each other.
They're in their own... I had a conversation with Fonda Lee about this. It's like the difference between defining something as a morally gray character or someone as a morally gray character and defining their world as being morally gray and their circumstances being morally gray. So it's like in her Greenbone saga, or like in your books, the circumstances of the world that they live in and the sort of like cultural and social norms that they deal with in everyday life being part of two rival gangster families, also in Greenbone Saga, rival gangster families, creates this sort of normalcy where other people might view that as like, you're fucked in the head.
Right.
But for them, it's like, this is their everyday life. And so it doesn't feel that far-fetched given what they're used to.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly it. It's like, are they repeatedly killing people for each other? Yes. But as far as that relationship is concerned, it also means they keep prioritizing their partner. It means they're always on the lookout for what their partner needs in life, right? That's healthy. That's super healthy.
Yeah. It's like Bonnie and Clyde, you know?
Exactly. There you go. Exactly. Maybe a less healthy example, but sure.
All that to say, I do think like pushing external circumstances is a really good way to make sure that, you know, the reader isn't bored by that couple, because we are still continuously seeing them make choices of the world about each other. But it's in a way that emphasizes this is actually a pairing that you want to root for. And on the flip side, you know, when they are actually toxic and unhealthy, and, you know, assuming that that is the point, like when I do it for the adult series, it is in a way saying something about their character. Like, I think if they are toxic because the author has chosen to glamorize it, I'm not a big fan of that, because then it's the entertainment for the sake of like, ooh, what if this was the case? Like, okay, that is the case often. It's not really something we should aspire to. But if it's highlighting the fact that they're toxic to say something about valuing power or valuing absolute control over the love they could have for this person, and it's saying something interesting about that character and what they want in this world, I think that's when you lean into the toxicity.
Yeah, it's like Ross and Rachel and Friends versus Chandler and Monica, you know what I mean?
That's a really good example. Yeah.
They're like sort of on like the opposite ends of the spectrum, but both are engaging in their own ways based on the external circumstances, and the ways in which those situations and how they react to them reflects upon their individual characters, but also on their like their identity as like a couple or like a relationship. Yeah. I'm just dropping all the references today.
I know. So you're full of those references today. It's great though. I think that's a great answer, focusing on those external factors. I want to talk a little bit about the remixing of classic, you know, kind of themes or storylines that you've been playing, that space you've been playing in a bit with your work so far. So your books, you know, they are putting these twists on a lot of famous literary love stories. And so I'm curious as to like, what's your secret for how you write these really compelling and still unpredictable romances, even though they're based on well-known stories? And then, do you find that the unpredictability or the surprise element in a romance, is that even, you know, something that is critical, right, to a romance storyline? Or, as you kind of mentioned earlier with the like capital R romance, is it more, you know, do the readers of those storylines want to go into the story with a general idea of how it ends up?
Oh, that is such an interesting thought. I feel like when I approach the, at least the storylines of the plays that I've adapted so far, a lot of my you know, the starting point I often take is that I have a very, very, very hot take about that relationship. And I believe it so firmly to the point where I have a non-zero amount of times had to forcibly stop myself from getting into an online fight with someone who has tweeted their like opinions about Romeo and Juliet. I think there's a viral tweet about Romeo and Juliet, like every few months, where they're either like, they were young people who didn't know what love was and they were stupid, or it's like, you know, it's Romeo and Juliet. Everyone has an opinion because it's a very, very famous play. But I, like, my hot take, right, is that they were very brave as teenagers of young people who were let down by the adults around them. And instead of continuing the cycle of hatred, dying for love was the brave thing that they chose to do. Should we encourage that with teenagers now? No. But at least what that story was trying to say, that is my, like, firm belief. So when I go into, like, anything that retells a story in some way, I'm very clear that I never want to change the heart of it, like what I believe makes that story so good. But I do want to change all of the context and put that heart back in and look what new shape does that build, right? So I have to be so clear, this is what I am setting out to like put as a pulse. And whatever that story around it turns into, I'm just going to let that like figure itself out. Which is almost why I think I surprised myself too. Like, I know the main, again, heart, but what is it going to turn into? I kind of just have to let the story, like, you know, show itself. With Roma and Juliet, like, they got their happily ever after in my version, but in the first draft, they actually died as well. Cause I was like, well, just, you know, this is how the story goes. I had that as one manuscript initially, and it wasn't until I sold it to my publisher and we split it into two books, and I even spent more time with the story and did new things to the characters, that the characters then took on different storylines and lived. So it's not that I go in thinking it definitely needs to hit this one ending or another one. It's more or less, I know what that theme I'm trying to get at is. But whatever the events that follow after, we just have to see how the context changes it.
Yeah, because it's like that spontaneity is really fun sometimes. And I feel like stories need that spontaneity. It's kind of cool that you like, you know, kind of approached it. It's like you had the beating heart, which is kind of like your foundation. And you were able to like build on top of that and pants the fabric around it and like the body around it to match you and like the way that you interpret Romeo and Juliet or Antony and Cleopatra or what have you. I was curious, like during that process, are you ever conscious of tropes in terms of, MJ was talking a little bit about expectations, but like, I feel like a lot of the expectations that romance readers have, especially in something like capital R romance, are expectations built upon tropes that have become so firmly integrated into that genre
and so beloved.
Like they love it, like they crave that thing. And it's really interesting to talk about tropes in a way where it's like people often hate them, but sometimes they really, really love them. So I was curious, do you have some favorite tropes when it comes to writing romance? And are there any that you were consciously steering clear of altogether in terms of like, I don't really need this in my story. I don't want this in my story. Or it would change my story in a way that wasn't working for me or the characters.
I feel like the tropes I was most aware of were, you know, how would the ending resolve? Like, I think, especially when it comes to Romeo and Juliet, like, everyone knows that they die at the end because it's just such a famous play, right? And so I almost just had to approach it by throwing that out completely and thinking, no matter what the trope is for the star-crossed lovers, I just have to do what suits the story, which, you know, as mentioned, I had them both die and then live, like in varying versions, because I think it's really hard to just decide to do one thing and then mold the story around it. I think it's oftentimes that does the story an injustice, in the same way that people talk about tropes now, where they're like, you can't come up with a list of tropes and write a book around that. It's going to feel flat. Tropes are things that serve the story in a helpful way, where, you know, you've already come up with the conceit and you know that these two characters are doing something, and you lean into, say, the trope of like fake marriage in order to really, you know, squeeze maximum potential out of a setup you already have. So I really try to think of it that way, like with Valet Fortune, because As You Like It is about like Rosalind going off to the forest and pretending to be someone for Orlando while he's like fake confessing and everything. I was like, this has a really good setup for what I want to use as the fake marriage that was really happening in 1930s Shanghai among the spies. And once I decided I want to work with this, I realized, oh, this is a trope. Let me look at what books do this trope really well. What is it that I really, really enjoy? And how do I make the most use of that in my own way without just falling on the trope to do the heavy lifting? Because I think there's so often when you see something and you're like, well, I see what you were trying to do with the trope, but there's no substance behind it. And that always happens if you go trope first instead of story first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like that.
I like that too.
No, that's good. Yeah. It's like emphasizing something, but not being wholly dependent on it, you know?
Right. It's like using it as a framework to, to work your clay around, right? Like they do that with the chicken wire when they make, people make sculptures. So you kind of, you've kind of segued for me here, which is fantastic. She's good. I know, you're crushing it. You haven't even seen the questions beforehand. It's awesome. because I wanted to ask you who some of your favorite fellow writers in this kind of romance subplot, romance, fantasy, sci-fi space are. And, of those other writers or, books in particular, if you have any that you really enjoy, what is it that they do well? And do you take inspiration from other writers? Which it sounds like perhaps if you're looking at other ones that do the tropes that you were realizing are kind of in the framework of your work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, the foundational works that built me as a person when I was growing up, Daughter of Smoke and Bone by Lainey Taylor. I think that is a book series that, in general is just gorgeous, beautifully done. Like city setting description, Lainey Taylor can do like no one else. It is just so well done. But also in the romance, like that is star-crossed lovers like to perfection. The way that there is a constant navigation of tension using external circumstances to pull them apart rather than like, relying too much on the internal battle. Beautiful, wonderfully done. The Raven Boys by Maggie Stiefvater. Again, atmosphere, wonderful. But the relationship between Blue and Gansey being such a slow burn across four books.
Wow.
So well done. That's
investment. Wow.
It is investment. And it's such like, it is something that I truly aim to be capable of one day. Because Blue and Gansey brush fingertips. See, this was what I was saying earlier. They brush fingertips in book three. And the entire fandom back then was just having the world's biggest freak out when Blue Lily Lily Blue came out. They were like, guys, he put his hand into the back seat and she touched it. It was
the ship
crazy.
Is setting sail or coming to harbor, whichever the metaphor is.
Exactly. So that was a series that like defined slow burn for me. Like that set the bar up there. As far as, books that I have been reading recently, Anne Leong writes YA contemporaries that I think is just the very height of YA like romance that I really wish that I could time travel and read it as a teenager. Like I'm so grateful that I can read it now, but if I had read it as a teenager, it would have been life-changing. And I'm so jealous of the teenagers who get to read it now as teenagers. Like, it is just so perfect. She is, every single book she puts out, complete banger. And, you know, I'm gobbling them up.
That's a book blurb right there. It's like, yeah.
I want to time travel and read this as my younger self.
Back and be, I want to be a teenager again so I can read this book. I'm so jealous of all the current teenagers.
I know, right? That is great. That's high praise for it, though. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Something you mentioned earlier, which is, and we've been talking about a little bit, is like capital R and little R romance. It's like, basically you can equate that to like main plot and subplot romance. Can you speak to the difference in approach between romance as a subplot and romance as the plot?
Ooh. Oh, that's a great question. I feel like I have only ever written romance as a subplot. So that's, I think, where, you know, I feel most comfortable in. Because I always think about, you know, what is that main plot being the theme that I'm trying to get at? And how does romance as a subplot help me emphasize that theme by way of the characters and their investment to it and their connectivity to that world? So it's like romance as a subplot to me is like that glue that just holds everything together, because it is that like constant go, go, go action behind it. Like, you have to care about the plot in order to finish reading the book, I guess. And it's like, well, why do you care whether or not these characters save the world or not? What are the real stakes that get you as a reader invested? And so often to me, it's like, well, do they fall in love along the way? And, you know, why does it matter if they save the world or not, if not for love? Why do we do anything in this world if not for love? Which doesn't even have to be romantic. Like, for a lot of books, like the found family aspect, is that love driving it? Or it could be the parent-child relationship. It could be the sibling relationship, right?
It could even be the friend relationship, the Tui to Han Solo, for instance.
Exactly. But it's just, it's human motivation. Like, humans are just fundamentally driven by the love you have for people around you. And you don't care about things like stakes, like saving the world, like solving the mystery, unless there are reasons, you know, to prevent or to finish or whatever it is that the goal is. I think romance with a capital R being the main plot is really hard, which is probably why I don't think I could ever be capable of writing that, because I'm gonna throw a murder in. Like, I just can't not kill people, you know?
Just spice it up a bit, man.
I can't help it. I really can't. Because capital R romance is so character focused. It's so much about getting the reader invested in that character first and foremost, that you care enough to go from meeting to being in love. And I'm just a bit too violent as a writer. Like, I
relatable.
Yeah.
Where's the shit that blows up?
Yeah, right. Exactly. The characters are too stabby for that. But yeah, no, I hear you.
MJ is all about the stab. So
yeah, right. Much more stabby than the romance. Well, you know, we have to get spicy at some point in here, because it is such a huge topic, and it's a large part of the romance genre, and has been for all time. So how do you feel about spicy books, including spice and fantasy novels? And as a kind of loaded question, sorry, but what are your thoughts around spice in YA books? Because I know that's always kind of a hot topic to debate.
I know it's a hot topic, but I feel like it shouldn't be. Like, I don't know why there is spice in YA. There really should not be, which is not to say there shouldn't be sex in YA. Like, there absolutely can be. But I think spice very specifically is sex or anything sexual for the purpose of like titillating the reader, right? Like, it is something that you get to and you're like, ooh, which should be for adults. I think if you are writing anything that is, character driven for the relationship in young adult, you are writing it in a way to develop the character, to develop that relationship, and to really like hone in on what is at stake? Why does this matter? Like, what is going on in their inner world? And those are teenagers. Like, why is it spicy? You know? Again, I don't think this should be a controversial take. I think there are so many well-done character arcs, dynamics, relationships in young adult that, yeah, maybe description-wise you could classify as spicy, but I just still wouldn't call it spicy because you can feel that the author went in thinking, how do I serve these characters best? How do I serve my teenage audience best? And how do I do justice to the scene? I think the problem happens, and again, this is an audience thing, when adults go in wanting these teenage characters to be written for adults. And that is when the demands for spice in YA start happening. And if YA is to be kept for teenagers, we can't keep letting that happen. Maybe that's a hot take. I don't know. I don't think it should be.
I think it's reasonable though, because it's like hormonally charged teenagers are titillated enough. It's like they don't necessarily need like...
Well, and I think it's an important distinction too that you've drawn, that is a distinction I haven't seen anyone draw, which, given I am kind of on the periphery of these conversations because I'm not in the YA space myself, but like there is a difference between a book being spicy and a book being sex positive, right? So it's absolutely, like, it's not saying that like, oh, we can't talk about sex in a book for teenagers, but maybe we shouldn't be approaching it in a way that is designed to arouse our audience when the characters like, are minors.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the psychology of sort of like arousal, and, you know, someone who's like growing up on porn is going to have a misconstrued idea of what sex and relationships and these kinds of things are about. And it's like, if a book that like, pornography doesn't have to be visual, like pornography can be textual too. And if it's just there for titillation and and there in a way that is creating an unhealthy expectation of what these kinds of situations and relationships would be like, then it's like, that is doing a disservice to the audience.
I always think about it in the way where, again, I always feel like I approach this with a different angle because I spent a lot of my like teenage years growing up, like with the conversation with YA being a teenager, where I think it's very different when teenagers are engaging with this media in their own way versus when adults are inserting it for adult audiences in the way that I think the spice and YA conversation oftentimes is. Like, you know, I remember as teenagers, like, you would often write fan fiction about two characters like that were very R-rated, but it was still ultimately about the characters, and it was kind of about your satisfaction seeing them get together. And that, I think, is also it's perfectly valid in the book as well. Like, finally, this is exactly what these characters needed. I still don't think that's spice, technically. That is just what the characters should culminate to as far as their relationship is concerned. I think anytime it becomes spice, it becomes for the adult audience, and that is the messy part.
Yeah. And it's a weird thing because there are no teenagers working in the publishing industry, you know?
There was.
You know,
when I was younger. Yeah.
You're like, yeah. Yeah, maybe like an internship or something like that. But then it's like, a lot of the times the market forces are dictating something that might not necessarily be
represented in the rooms of those decision makers.
Yeah, exactly. For the audience and that stuff.
Yeah. I really think YA publishing should get like teenage like testers. Like just
interns in the room. What do they do in like Hollywood where they have like test audiences and stuff like that? Yeah.
Right? Or whatever, just, like the age specific like sensitivity read, but like for the age specific audience, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Something similar.
That'd be onto something.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Okay. Well, wrapping up, we have some fun rapid fire questions for you. First off, out of all the couples in your books, who do you think is actually endgame?
I think Roma and Juliet and Rosalind and Orion are definitely endgame. Like, I have a tendency to write couples that are endgame. Like, I'm like, what is the point of writing them in YA? In YA. My YA couples, what is the point if not for them to have their happily ever after? So I really do believe that they are together forever, very happily.
who's absolutely getting divorced?
Or not even making,
making it that far. Not even putting a ring on it.
Well, I feel like it's the easy answer to say Anton and Kella. Like, they might kill each other before they ever get to marriage certificate, you know? But this is kind of a cheat answer as well. Phoebe and Silas in Foul Lady Fortune, not to say they would get divorced permanently, but I think they are the on and off couple where their external circumstances just keep putting new hurdles in their way, even after the end of the duology. Like, they are still at a point where things are really, really hard for as long as they choose their separate jobs. So I think they would like break up and then get together and then break up and get together and get divorced for funsies and then get married again and then get divorced again. That kind of dynamic.
Ross,
you know? Rachel.
But like slightly less toxic.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, but for external factors, not just them being
exactly
toxic for.
It's like married for like tax benefits and then divorced for like, you know, like appearances and then married for real. Things like that.
Oh, beautiful. Okay. Amazing. Imagine Rosalind, Kala, Anton, or any of your characters had a Tinder profile. What would their bio say? Or pick a couple characters that you think would have like the best bios.
I just, you know, if I had the time to write their like slice of life novellas, like Anton and Kella would, you know, try out the online dating scene in that world.
Would they be like having dinner with each other and swiping on Tinder at the same time?
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Under the table.
Yeah. No, not even on, like, under the table. On top of the fucking table.
Too, like, you know?
Oh,
it's like
they don't
actually care. Yeah. It's like it's not for the swiping for the sake of it. It's to see how the other person reacts when they get caught.
Exactly.
Oh my God,
spite swipe, man. Spite swipe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think Anton would be the type of person to have like 6 feet if it matters. Like that.
Absolutely.
Oh my God.
Although with all his body switching, it's like 6 feet yesterday, 5'8" today.
Exactly. 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 I feel like Kella would just have like a series of emojis or something. Like she doesn't have time.
Like really cryptic though.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Not the normal ones. Just some random ass ones.
Who would have a picture of like them with like two friends, but it's from behind and they're in bikinis and it only shows their asses and you can't really tell who's who?
Anton. That's a classic.
Absolutely. Oh my God. I love it. I love it. Okay. I have to ask, because we know readers always have opinions when they're reading, and I love to ship characters together. I had to explain to Adrian earlier this week what shipping
no
was. He'd
idea.
Never heard of it.
No.
I was like, oh, you sweet summer child. Let me bring you on this horrible
journey.
I am
just like tainted in other ways.
He's like, well, but what is the most like out of pocket or just random ship that you've heard like your fans or readers talk about amongst characters from your book where you're like, what?
Oh my God, I have an answer for this. There's one scene in either These Violent Delights or Our Violent Ends where Tyler, who is the antagonist in a sense, he's Juliet's cousin on her paternal side. He's just off somewhere doing bad things. And Rosalind, who, you know, she's not the protagonist yet. She's still a side character, like in the first duology. She's having a very tense encounter with him because she's like trying to stop him from doing that. And it gets to a point where she like reaches out to grab him. And there's a moment where they're like clearly fighting. And someone tagged me and was like, is this chemistry that I sense? And I'm like, I know they're not technically related because Rosalind is Juliet's cousin on her maternal side. So Rosalind and Tyler are not blood related.
Yeah.
That's still weird.
It's too close.
It's also like, contextually, it's just like their fingers didn't graze. It's like they're fighting each other.
Yeah, contextually they're having, but that's the thing. That's like, there are some people who see like two characters that are about
any
to like
contact
each other and they're like,
The dagger to the throat thing. And yes. I think the lovers, it is a huge trope.
Ooh, just getting into some fetishes and shit.
It is. That is definitely the most out of pocket thing that I have seen. Because I immediately was like, oh, don't say that.
You're like, no. Don't let this ship set sail.
Yeah.
Which of your characters, if any, would you be most interested in dating in real life? And who would you absolutely not want to date?
Assuming they're all adults. Or you're a teenager. Like, assuming it's legit.
Which, I did write them as a teenager, so I feel like I can answer this. I think Orion would be so fun because he's just chaos on legs. And Stair Claire completely is August from Immortal Longings. Like, he will probably throw you off a building for funsies.
I can see that. Legit.
Yeah.
That's toxicity at its worst.
Right. Exactly. Amazing. Awesome. Well, to close out, do you have any final advice for authors like me looking to add some romance to their stories?
Lots of finger grazes, I think, is always the best starting
point.
Dirty
or clean, it doesn't matter.
Exactly. I feel like I love thinking about, like, in the context of the characters, what is the most enticing thing that is going to run in their mind on a loop? Like, I just think about when you are, you know, on the trajectory of any romantic arc in, like, real human life, you will overplay the tiniest thing into, like, the biggest saga. Like, you will call your friend, you'll be like, oh my God, they said this. Like, what does it mean? And your friend will look at the text and be like, that's 2 exclamation points. And you're like, I know, 2 exclamation points.
And emojis. Emojis just made everything so confusing.
Oh my God. Emojis are basically hieroglyphics. Like, there's a whole language of that. So it's like, I always think of it as like, what is the fictional equivalent of that? Like, what makes someone cycle through it? And even if they don't have the time to think about it in the like narrative arc of the story, let the reader think about it for them. Like, what are the moments that create that reaction?
Yeah, because it's like you're tickling their imaginations and trying to like get them involved in such a way where it's like that investment is what keeps them going.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Like, yeah, I love that, because it's not just in romance that can be applied to just like good fiction in general. What are those things that you can plant into your story that are going to be the like the lingering,
like the emotional touch points?
Where the reader's just like, I can't put it down because it's like this chapter ended and I have to see what happens next, and it just keeps them going and going and going.
Love it
All right, well, that's it for this mini masterclass and our two-parter with Chloe. Thank you so much for bringing the spice to SFFX.
Of course.
We appreciate it.
I love giving the hot takes, the spicy takes, per se.
It's very much appreciated. All right, Chloe, where can folks find you online?
They can find me at The Chloe Gong across all social media, or www.thechloegong.com. Because Chloe Gong.
Forget about the other Chloe Gong. We don't know her.
This is the only Chloe Gong we care about.
Exactly.
And go pick up Chloe's books because they're fantastic. Even if you are, okay, so I am a bit, not that I'm averse to YA, but it's
you just don't read a lot of it.
I just don't read a lot of it, or I'm like, I wasn't conscious that I was reading YA, but like reading your books, they don't feel like YA. It's like I read those books and I'm the person who's like, oh shit, she's dropping history tidbits and everything like that. I'm like your perfect fucking audience. Because it's like,
I'm a genre blender.
But you like pull me in with that stuff, so it's like there's so much to enjoy about it. There's so much, there's like action and good characters and good dialogue and death and blowing shit up and just like,
I love that.
Yeah, Chloe is like a genre blending chaos monster. It's great.
That's gonna be my new bio on social media.
Genre blending chaos monster.
Yeah.
New York Times bestseller and chaos monster.
Right.
That's what I'm all about. You can also follow SFF Addicts on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, all that stuff. at SFF Addicts Pod. You can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. MJ, what about you?
Yep, you can find me across all the socials at MJ Kuhn Books, all one word, or at just mjkuhn.com.
And at mjkuhn.com, you can pick up her free story when you sign up for her newsletter. It's all about a sham wizard. And then after you read that and you're like obsessed and want more, then you can go buy these books.
You get the free book first, and then you can pay for my cat's treats with the other ones.
Yeah. Feed Thorin.
Feed Thorin, open shield.
We should just come up with a meme, just like Feed Thorin.
And then people will think I'm abusing my cat. No, I don't like that.
No, she treats her cat real well. But Thorin gets first priority when it comes to food. Yeah. All right. Thank you, everybody. Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.